This podcast is sponsored by Alt Legal. Alt Legal, easy to use IP docketing with powerful automation, deadline calculation, and reporting. Hello and welcome to the Alt Trademarks podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Samendinger. On this episode, I was joined by Joanne Holmes, the founder of Holmes at Law. Joanne has practiced trademark and commercial law for 17 years. Jo particularly enjoys strategizing with business leaders to understand their goals with a focus to live the firm's slogan, Your Business Ally. You can contact Jo at holmesatlaw.com and on Twitter at holmesatlaw. You can find out more about Alt Legal on Twitter at altlegalhq and at altlegal.com. Thank you for joining us and enjoy. Hi, Joanne. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me, Hannah.
Absolutely. To get started, can you tell us a little bit about your current practice?
Sure. So I am the founder of Holmes at Law, which is a practice that focuses on contracts. And so that would be sort of all of the types of agreements that businesses need with their customers and their vendors, as well as trademarks domestically and internationally, and the software and tech space.
Great. And before you started your practice, we'll start at the beginning. You went straight from undergrad to law school. Was that always what you had in mind for your career?
I decided that I wanted to become an attorney when I was 11 years old, but what I do today has nothing to do with what inspired me. The takeaway that lasts is I've always been a person who felt compelled to stand up for folks who didn't have information or didn't have power, and it sort of bothered me when people were taken advantage of, and that was the spark that ignited the legal interest when I was 11. I did do an internship with a local public defender's office when I was in law school and had some interest in justice issues. But when I was in law school, I learned about intellectual property, and it just sparked an interest in me. I love the creativity of it. And having gone to Stanford as an undergrad and coming out of that really innovation-focused culture, I thought this is something that has to continue to be in demand. And so I learned as much as I could about IP through summer internships and the classes that were offered at Emory Law. And it's been a great career. So yes, I went straight from undergrad to law school, knowing that I wanted to be an attorney, but frankly, not even knowing the term intellectual property when I was a first year.
And now you've been practicing IP since about 1999. And so has it changed drastically from when you started? Is it, you know, you see some of the same issues? I imagine there's been, with technology, there's been a lot of changes as well.
There are some things that have certainly evolved, which you would expect. If we hadn't evolved from an IP standpoint since 1999, we'd probably be in bad shape. But then there are other things that have been consistent. So, you know, when I started, for example, we had .com, but literally I remember writing an article as a junior attorney on the rollout of .biz and .info, which seems, you know, forever ago now, I'm sure. I remember writing an article as well on the introduction of the Madrid Protocol when I was in my first role at Big Law. And so, yes, some things have changed a lot. The fundamentals of trademark practice have stayed the same. The key underpinnings around investing in a brand and building up that goodwill and ensuring that you protect that territory. And I give the analogy, don't build your house on someone else's land. So don't build your brands that belong to someone else. Those things have stayed the same. But it's what I have really enjoyed is the ongoing ability to work with creative professionals. And that's been a constant across my career, whether at a big law firm in-house or now being a solo practitioner.
Oh, that's great. And you went from big law to in-house. What was that transition like?
So I started out as the first attorney in my family. And so, you know, my role model was Claire Huxtable, who was not an IP lawyer and certainly not a transactional one at that. So quite frankly, I learned a lot as I went, and I was very fortunate to be at a firm where there were a number of people who extended their knowledge and kindness to me and helped answer questions that I had about potential career paths in law. And I remember having some really frank conversations with folks about the partnership track and them telling me that it was sort of like being in a pie eating contest and the prize is more pie. And I just thought about the kind of life that I wanted to have. I'm a single mom. My daughter was born 4 months after I started practicing law. So I learned how to be a parent and a lawyer at the same time. And it was always important to me to have a balance and not have regrets about being there for my daughter, but also to do really outstanding work for my clients. And so I made the decision that partnership was probably not the right track for me and started thinking about in-house roles as a mid-level associate, which is, I'm sure, what a lot of people do. And the transition for me was great. In particular, I was recruited for both of the in-house roles that I had because of my IP background and having done extensive IP clearance and portfolio management domestically and abroad. And so that was really a feather in my cap for having the opportunity to go in-house. But then once I got there, I always worked in very lean law departments, which meant I was the lawyer and for my business unit. I just had to jump in and learn the business and figure out how to do the work that was necessary to support those business units. And I really loved it. I did not know going in-house that I was going to enjoy the business side of things so much, and was very fortunate to get to serve on international management teams with products in 70 countries around the world. So for somebody who was a cultural anthropology major, that was great for me to get to have, you know, such a diverse experience, including the IP and the business side and the cultural realities of being on teams that have a presence all over the world.
Great. And then after that, you transitioned to solo practice. How were the transitions different between big law to in-house and in-house to solo?
You know, Hannah, I will tell you, when I left my big law experience, I really thought I would never go back. I really liked, as I said, being part of a business and focused on hitting strategic goals and understanding how the legal work impacted our EBITDA targets and so forth. And so I just couldn't see myself going back into an outside counsel role. But again, being a parent impacted my thinking. I was in a great position where I was nicely compensated, but I was leaving home in the dark and coming home in the dark, hardly seeing my daughter, certainly not seeing our extended family or my friends, and not doing service work and the kinds of things that really create a balance and make me a happier go. So
right.
I had to really stop and think about what kind of life do I want for myself and for my family. And it was tough because I really enjoyed my clients. I like to this day the people who I worked with in both of my in-house roles. But I decided to give myself some time off, and I took a sabbatical last summer. And during that, I'm a person of faith, and I did lots of prayer and just kind of thinking about what to do next and being honest with myself about what I really enjoy doing in the practice of law. And that's how I arrived at, you know, I always enjoy the creative side of things and the trademark work. And I also really enjoy thinking through the strategy of commercial agreements. And so that's how I arrived at what I wanted to do. And I thought about who I wanted to help. And, you know, being accessible, if I had gone back to big law, frankly, I would have probably billed at a rate that would not have made me accessible to small or even some mid-size organizations. And so it was a transition that I made with a lot of thought and prayer and planning. And I now look back at that and say the thought and prayer was good, but the planning was a bit of a joke because my practice is not much like what I thought it would be. But, you know, it taught me to adapt, which was this is always a good skill set to have.
Definitely. That's a great transition story. It's really something admirable. Have you found that your background in big law as well as in-house counsel has helped with your solo practice? You mentioned that you really like the business side of things when you were in-house, and I know some solos, that's kind of the bane of their, you know, existence when they start a solo practice, that all of a sudden they have to do business things, and law school doesn't necessarily teach you how to run a business. But did you find those things helpful when you were starting off your own practice?
You know, I don't think that law school teaches you how to run a business or how to be a lawyer. It teaches you how to think which is a great skill to have. It teaches you how to analyze and identify missing information, and all of those, again, are great skills to have. But I learned how to be a lawyer, and I learned how to run a business while practicing law. And so, yes, absolutely. I'm extremely grateful to this day that I worked with extraordinary attorneys who are at the top of their game, very smart and capable as a baby lawyer. And so my proving ground when I learned how to practice IP law and do commercial law was with attorneys who had a standard that became my standard. And I have to tell you, I was really kind of naive for a long time. I didn't realize that not everybody was practicing to that standard, because I also worked with great lawyers in-house. And so it was a surprise to me later on in my career when I interacted with some folks who just, I kind of thought, this isn't what I'm accustomed to. And but beyond the great education that I got in terms of how to be client service focused, how to be responsive, how to listen to clients, how to think about the implications of the legal advice that I'm giving, that I got at the law firm, I also got that in-house. I mean, I think, quite frankly, until I became an in-house lawyer, I might have been practicing from a theoretical perspective. And anybody who does trademark work knows you have to understand the implications for real consumers when you're doing trademark clearance or giving clients advice or arguing before the PTO, for that matter. But when you are on a management team and when you are the lawyer being called to say, we need to let X number of people go. I am a person who has folks in my family who cover the whole strata of socioeconomics. And so I'm always thinking, this is going to impact families. And that made things very real for me in understanding the realities of managing business budgets and growing the business and hitting targets, because I didn't want to have those conversations about letting people go. And I did want to have the conversations about, we're doing a great job and growing the business and everybody's benefiting from that. So serving on management teams gave me the chance to see every perspective of the business, be it working with the president or the CEO and being the confidant to talk through issues in a way that they felt comfortable coming to me, or the head of R&D and thinking about innovation issues, or HR, or logistics and warehousing. All of those people were on the same team as me, and I got to understand what their concerns were and why. So now, being in solo practice, my goal is really to live the firm's slogan, which is your business ally, and come at my relationships with clients from the perspective that if you just need a form, then there are places you can go to get a form. I want to understand what you're trying to achieve as a business and bring my experience in business to bear in helping give you quality legal advice that helps achieve your goals.
And I mean, you've gotten advice from other attorneys when you're working through these processes. Do you have any advice that you would give to someone who is looking to start their own solo practice?
There are two bits of advice that I give generally, no matter who I'm speaking to, because I find that they are universally appropriate. One of them is, you don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. And I think that that is true in terms of starting a solo practice, because again, to go back to the example of working with advertisers, I spent money that I wish I hadn't spent because I thought I was asking the right questions and I thought I had done the right research, but I really didn't have all the information that I probably would prefer now to have had. And so I didn't negotiate the best deal in terms of that advertising opportunity, but I learned a lot. And so I negotiate those deals much better now. And the same thing goes in the client-facing front. It took some time for me to figure out, especially having been in-house for so long, what's a reasonable rate for my services, be that hourly or a flat rate. And it's a work in progress all the time, figuring that out. And so I would say, yeah, that's a key thing. You can't just expect that you're going to be a good lawyer and provide great service and that you're going to get that back in terms of the value that you're offering. You've got to negotiate your value. The second bit of advice that I consistently give is, if you don't set your own agenda, someone else will. And I particularly give that advice to women, because I feel that there are a lot of folks who may have very good intentions, who can direct someone in one way or another, and that might not be what's genuinely right for me. So I'm happy to have an abundance of counsel and wisdom from people who I respect, but at the end of the day, I have to trust my voice and my intuition. So part of that is me being willing to refer business to other attorneys and not take on everything that someone approaches me about, because that doesn't align with my agenda. That doesn't align with the type of work I enjoy doing and I'm good at. And so I make a point of putting people in contact with good attorneys who can support them on those things. But it's not always easy, because I know that's revenue that I'm sending out the door. So I think just constantly being thoughtful about what is it that I want, or in giving advice, what is it that whomever I'm advising really values, and being careful to stick to that agenda and not get sidetracked on things that might not align to where you want to be.
Those are both great pieces of advice. Switching gears just a little bit, over the course of your career, so between big law, in-house, and now solo, I'm sure you've seen countless technology solutions and how different attorneys use technology in practice. How do you use technology as a solo practitioner?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I use it, it's integral to my practice now, but I think about it, really, it has been over the course of my entire career. So if you think about 1999, when I started, was really a bit of a dot-com boom. And the fact that I was able to have my infant on my lap at the same time that I had my laptop on my lap and, you know, be able to work remotely as a mom, and at the same time be doing really sophisticated work for, you know, literally on a global basis for very well-regarded clients, that was possible by virtue of the fact that I had the ability to dial into a network and access the materials that I needed, or the ability to go on the internet and grab what I needed. Over the course of my career, I have always been a fan of having fewer things that do more things. So I was a very early adopter of smartphones. I had a Handspring that I think turned into a Trio back in 2003. Far before the introduction of the iPhone. And I will confess that before I was talking to you, I was watching an Apple event on the introduction of the latest iPhone. But the capabilities of smartphones have just made my life easier to balance. And so, you know, I can be at my daughter's volleyball game and be checking emails and responding to clients. So it just makes it possible to do the things that are important to me in tandem with one another. I'm going through the process right now of hiring a virtual staff, and I found immensely talented people through Upwork and sites like that who I'm going to call on to do virtual assistant work or paralegal work or for junior attorney level work. I'm even going to hire a marketing manager that way. And these are folks who I am not going to pull on as full-time staff, but for as needed basis, which allows me to not have that additional cost center for the firm, but still get really talented people who can support my growth objectives and help me in servicing my clients. So, you know, I'm thinking through things like, I use Google Voice, and how am I going to share things through Google Voice with that team, or setting up Slack channels for communication. I use Fiverr, for example, to help me with some things that I needed to do early on in terms of logo work and so forth. So for me, again, using those apps and tools, and, you know, literally I use my Apple Watch to keep track of what's happening, you know, if I haven't got my iPhone right next to me. All of those things are helpful. And then, as I think I might have mentioned before, I listen to podcasts constantly. So the fact that I don't need to take time away from my practice to go sit in a seminar and learn some of the fundamental things that I've learned around marketing or practice management is invaluable, because I can do that while I'm driving or while I'm doing laundry or while I'm doing the dishes. And I kind of feel like I'm getting a free MBA with all the information that I've learned from folks who are just willing to share their knowledge about solo and small firm practice or IP practice. So it's just been, it's not possible, I don't think, for me to work the way that I have worked across the course of my 17-year career without immensely integrating technology of one type or another.
Yeah, it sounds like you have a great tech stack built that helps you manage your whole practice. How did you go about finding the right tools for you? Did you have any trial and error? Did you just sort of gradually acquire these different tools to build out your tech stack?
Both of those. I mean, before I started the practice, I am a person who falsely comforts myself into thinking I've thought about these things and it's all going to be okay. I should really take my comfort in the fact that I probably haven't thought about everything, but I've made it this far, so I'll probably be okay from here on out too. So I did a lot of research, and some of it is trial and error. I built my website, for example, on the Wix platform. If I had it to do again, I would absolutely go the WordPress route. But having thought I had done my research, I thought, oh, Wix is the way to go. But over the course of time, I've learned everybody uses WordPress, and there are so many plugins and so forth that are more convenient if you're using that platform. In terms of the podcast, it's really been a trial and error. I'll listen to a great podcaster who will suggest another great podcast, or I'll go on iTunes and type in law or attorney or lawyer, and I'll stumble upon things that way. In terms of the tools, you know, I started out with Google for Business, and that was really great because Google gets it. I made the right choice at the beginning on that one. Other things I vacillated back and forth on for quite some time. I went back and forth for a while on should my newsletter be on MailChimp or Constant Contact, and set up accounts on both and just kind of tried them out and figured out which one of these makes the most sense. In terms of, you know, communication tools, I had a Google Voice account years and years ago, and I thought, you know, I really like this and I like the tools that come with it, and it's in the Google ecosystem. In terms of the hardware I use in my practice, my family started using Apple products sometime before I did, and I just thought they were cool. And so, like I'm sure a lot of people, I started with an iPhone and then got an iPad and then got a Mac and now have the Apple Watch. And so the ecosystem just makes sense for me because, as Mr. Cook would say, it just works. Which actually should probably be attributed to Mr. Jobs now that I think about it. But I'm always looking for solutions that allow me to be mobile. If I can seamlessly check a notification on my Apple Watch and then grab my iPhone and act on it, or literally this afternoon, I giggled at what a geek I am, which is, you know, I take pride in that because I'm a Stanford grad, so we're known to be nerds, but I was sitting at my desk and I had something streaming from my phone, controlling the volume from my Apple Watch. I just was listening to a podcast the other day and it occurred to me that my, you know, very, very early stage iPad could be a second screen for me. So I was rebooting it and setting it up to use it for that purpose while I was, you know, doing substantive work on my Mac. And I was like, you are such a fangirl. This is a little bit embarrassing with the Apple ecosystem. But when I find something that works for me, and so I don't have to think about that, and I can focus on the more complex things that I need to do to support my clients or my business, I stick with it and I become an evangelist for it because I want everybody else to be able to have great tools too.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sort of general recommendations for a solo practitioner or really any attorney who's looking to incorporate more technology into their practice? Maybe a good starting point or just some general tips you've learned?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few different areas. If I were thinking through sections, I would say on the calling and communications front, I haven't needed a receptionist, but I've heard great things about Ruby Receptionist. If you are comfortable with answering your own phone and you want the ability for it to ring in different places, I think Google Voice has been an excellent tool. But then, there can be some issues with Google Voice in terms of how it shows up. So, is it a personal call or a business call? So I've heard some people prefer Skype over Google Voice for that reason. I'm really excited about when, I build out the virtual staff using Slack, which I think is going to be a good mid-ground between, say, text messaging and emailing, so we can get each other's attention pretty quickly. I'd say, in terms of the financial tech side of things, there are some good options out there. And I thought about using, and I can't remember the name of it, but I thought about using something free. But ultimately, in talking to my CPA, we just went with QuickBooks. And I use QuickBooks not only for the financial side of things, in terms of accounting, but also for invoicing. And that works just fine for me. So I don't have an additional tool for invoicing or time tracking. I just do that through QuickBooks. I remember calling my local bar, my state bar, I should say, and when I was trying to figure out the whole what can go in a trust account versus an IOLTA account and so forth, I mean, they didn't outright tell me so, but they basically said if you don't want to get in trouble, you should use LawPay. And so I have done that, and that has been really a great win. Over the course of the year that I've been with them, they've done tutorials and helped me through some of the credit card and merchant services compliance things that I've needed to do. They also have a great tool built in with LawPay called QuickBill, where you can put in an invoice number and the account, be it Trust or IOLTA, and the amount, and then create a link that I can drop into an email so my clients can pay me by credit card through that tool, which has been really great for making sure that I'm not getting into cash flow issues and getting paid when it makes sense for me to get paid. I think those are, and then on the marketing front, I would say, again, MailChimp has been helpful for me. One of the big surprises that I just never would have guessed is that Yelp is apparently the number one site for finding lawyers. I use Yelp when I'm in a foreign city and I'm looking for something good to eat. But they're apparently, Yelp has a huge reputation in terms of identifying lawyers. I, for example, advertise with Avvo, and I found that to be useful. I would say also, and this isn't necessarily tech, but it's along the lines of things to do on the front end, I spent some time when I started my practice just going through and correcting my profile. So some of the online directories still made reference back to the first firm I worked at that I left in 2004. So it was really worthwhile to update that information so that people could find me with accurate information and accurate reflection of what my practice is now, my website, and so forth. And I started that with Google, but there are a number of online directories for businesses and then some focused specifically on lawyers. And I think all of that was time well spent so that over the course of time, it helped with my SEO and people being able to locate me.
I think that's a great start for a beginning tech stack. Okay, next I'm just going to ask you a series of rapid fire questions. They're just for fun. Ready?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, what's the last book you read?
I think the last book that I read mostly cover to cover, because I rarely read anything cover to cover, was The Confidence Code, which was great. It was actually instrumental in me starting my firm. And there are not many books that I've read that I can say were really impactful in my life. But The Confidence Code was. It's by Kati Kay and Claire Shipman. And it was great because it impacted me both from the sort of analytic lawyerly side of me and also the just the go-get-em ambitious side of me. But it was great because it was the message of the book was just get started. You're smart enough and you'll figure it out as you go.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out. What's your favorite productivity hack?
I have to tell you, I am going to sound like I am way, way behind on this, and I know that I am, but for the longest time, I kept saying, I need to implement Google filters, and what they call them, I think, is labels. because my inbox is crazy. I was just getting so much stuff, and I wanted to focus on the things that really matter and require my attention. And so literally this past weekend, I just went online, figured out how to set it up, and I have been dogmatic about it. And so now the great listservs that I find great content from, be it from a law practice perspective, a IP-specific perspective, or a marketing and advertising slant, all of that stuff now is still there for me to see, but it's not clogging up the emails from my clients or folks who I really need to pay attention to. So it's just made me a lot more productive to not have to sift through that stuff or not let it cause my attention to get misdirected when I could be focused on doing the things I really need to do.
I love using those labels. Do you have a favorite IP blog or newsletter, anywhere you get IP news?
I have a few of them. One of the ones that I'm liking now, I mean, it's gonna sound less honest than it is, but I'm really liking the one that you guys have been putting out the past few weeks.
Oh, thank you.
I find information there that I haven't seen in other places. It's aesthetically nice to look at, and it's written, and I know that this sounds like simplistic coming from an attorney, but it's written in a way that it's comfortable to read. So I really like that, and I'm going to contrast it to one that is not comfortable to read but has great content, which is e-trademarks. I think Oppenhall, if I'm not mistaken, does that one. But it's, you know, it's great content from practitioners in this area, but it's not fun to look at. And if there's anything our friends at Apple have taught us, make it nice for people to look at and they're more likely to want to do it.
Okay, last one. What would you be doing if you weren't an attorney?
I would be working on behalf of women and girls in the developing world. So in Atlanta, where I live in the Atlanta metro area, there's this great organization called CARE that is probably known for care packages way, way back decades ago. But what they do now is really focus on supporting healthcare, finances, and education for women and girls in the developing world, with the ideology that if you educate a girl, then she becomes an educated mother, and then that has a ripple effect into that community and the larger society and the country and the world. And time again, studies have proven that investing in a girl is one of the most productive ways to lift communities out of poverty. So if I didn't need to earn a living and I didn't have a child on her way to college in a few years, I would probably just work for an organization like CARE and try to focus on doing the most effective things to meet the goal of poverty alleviation.
It's a wonderful alternative career. Okay, and that's it. That's it for our interview. Thank you so much for joining us, Joanne. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for the listeners?
I would just say, you know, I have so much appreciated the kindness of people who have been honest about their experience, what they've done well and what they haven't. And I appreciate a forum like this to do that. Everybody out there who's sharing the good, bad, and the ugly, thank you for doing that. I think it helps our community.
Great. Thanks so much, Joanne.
Thank you for having me.
That's this week's episode. Thank you for joining us, and see you next time.